It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Put down that juicer and the kale smoothie for a moment and consider this from primatologist Richard Wrangham. He's author of Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human.
What struck me is that nobody has paid attention to this amazingly important system of food processing, of cooking. And the reason it seems so fantastically important is that we all know that you are what you eat. And we all know that for animals, the search for food is absolutely critical. And what people have not paid attention to is the fact that there's tremendous amount of evidence that when we cook, we get much more energy out of our food than if we eat it raw.
Could be a controversial hour. Lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Spring brings wonderful new tastes. And during our Splendid Table fundraiser, I've assembled four of my favorite spring recipes, especially for you. It's a free bonus gift when you make a contribution in any amount to keep The Splendid Table strong. Your support really helps and can make your spring a little more delicious. Visit splendidtable.org/donate today before these recipes, like spring itself, disappear. And thanks. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The donut made me do it. That's good enough reason to explain what tossed you off the diet wagon. Then again, maybe it's time to check out a theory that doesn't pivot on sheer willpower. If lifelong healthy eating is the goal, Brian Wansink's work might have some answers. He's the professor and director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab. He and his team do hundreds of tests and studies to fully understand why we eat what we eat. His latest book is Slim by Design: Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life. Brian, welcome back.
It's great to be with you again.
So you divided the book into five categories: home, restaurants, supermarkets, workplace, school. Let's talk about the home. Where should we begin in the kitchen?
Well, what you don't want to do is to say, I can't eat this food, or I have to eat less of this food, because if we consciously try to control what we eat, it takes way too much time. Most of us have way too much in our mind to kind of say, you know, let me eat half the pea and stop and ask if I'm hungry. It's a whole lot easier to just simply use a smaller plate, you know, serve yourself 22% less. It's a whole lot easier to clear your counters of everything but a fruit bowl. It's easier to cut up fruit and put it in your refrigerator. And what you're going to find is you're going to double, triple your fruit consumption. You're going to reduce how much other stuff you eat. But you're going to be doing it unconsciously, and that's why it becomes slim by design and not slim by willpower. You know, everything in slim by design is based on studies that we've done, and even a cluttered counter. So what happened, we brought people in one day. We brought them in the kitchen. They're supposed to meet somebody for lunch there. And we had three really tasty snacks sitting on the table. And for half the people, the table, the rest of the kitchen was totally organized and clear. For the other half, is totally cluttered. There's mail on the table. There's an open newspaper. There were dishes drying in the dish rack. Mm-hmm. Just really disorganized, like many kitchens we see. And what we found is that when people came in this cluttered kitchen and had to wait for their confederate to show up, they ended up eating about 44% more snacks just because the environment was disorganized. Well, I mean, that's an easy thing to do in your kitchen. If having a cluttered kitchen is going to make you snack a lot more, well, the secret to that is not saying, now that I know it, I won't snack. No, the secret is just declutter your kitchen and both you and your family are going to eat better. And in most U.S. kitchens, there are 4 to 5 cupboards that have snacks in them. But if we isolate all those snacks, we don't get rid of any of them, but we isolate them all to just one cupboard, what happens is snacking goes down dramatically. Now, you might say, well, you know, the best thing that I could do is I could just not buy that stuff to begin with. And yeah, that might be a solution for some people. But we also find that if you totally deprive yourself of things you like, it usually comes back to bite you. And also in most of our homes, it's not just us who we are serving. It's also our family, mm-hmm. kids and things like this. And so it's probably important for some people that there be those snacks. But they just need to be isolated in the same place so that every time you open the cupboard, you're not saying, hey, do I want that?
You also talk about rearranging your refrigerator in an interesting way.
Yeah. You know, if you want your kids to eat a whole lot more fruit, if you want to eat a whole lot more fruit, you don't want to put it in the bins where it's just going to compost eventually.
Right.
Taking it out and putting it on the middle shelf really helps what people decide to eat. So we've done a number of these studies too where we've taken leftovers, either healthy leftovers or unhealthy leftovers. The less healthy it is, the more we wrap it in like aluminum foil or put it in an opaque container. If it's really good, we put it in transparent wrap or a see-through container. And what it will do in one day is move you more toward eating the healthier stuff.
What about what we do at the table or how we set up a table?
Now, what we've done in research in the past is we've shown that simply if you use a plate that's any size other than about 9 to 10 inches in diameter, you're going to overeat. Okay. If it's too big of a plate, which is what most of us have, like an 11 or 12-inch plate,
right,
you're going to end up serving about 20 to 22% more food, and as a result, you'll overeat. If you have too small of a plate, let's say a little 6-inch saucer, you kind of realize you're perceptually fooling yourself. So you have seconds and thirds and fourths. And it's a great way to reduce portion size for those of us who want our pasta or our eggplant Alfredo, but don't want to overeat it because the smaller plate will lead you to eat smaller. But for other people, and these are often men, our problem is we're fast eaters, so we tend to have seconds and thirds of a lot of things, whether it be the pasta or the meatballs or whatever is on the table. And we found that simply serving off of a counter or a stove instead of having that big bowl sitting right in the middle of the table
reduces
how much people eat of that food by about 20%. And for guys, actually, it's closer to 30%. For women, it's about 10% because women tend to go back fewer times for seconds and thirds. And it's an easy, easy way to cut 20% of a food out of your diet without even really knowing it.
And you have fewer bowls to wash and platters. How does color play into all of this?
The color of a plate does bias how much you serve. So the more of a contrast there is between the color of your plate and what you're serving, the less you're going to serve. Okay. So if you have a bright red plate and you're putting on, you know, like noodles or rice or something, you're going to put about 20% less on than if you're putting white on white. Because the white on white just the contrast isn't there and doesn't jump out at you. So, and I mean, the easy fix for most of us isn't to have an infinite number of color plates. The fix for most of us is just simply have some darker plates, because most things we're in danger of overeating are carbohydrates, like rice or pasta.
Right,
or potatoes,
they're white. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the big takeaway is that it's a whole lot easier to make your kitchen work for you than against you. It's a whole lot easier to become slim by design than slim by willpower. What we found is just even making one of those changes will make a non-dieter who does it every day lose, on average, about 1.5 pounds every month. But that's a non-dieter. So it has a tremendous impact, not just on us, but it has an impact on our spouse or on our kids. But what's important is that the home is only one of five places where we eat food. These same sort of things can be done in grocery stores, restaurants, where we work and where kids go to school. And there, when a change is made or we encourage those places to make a change, it doesn't just influence us, but it influences, you know, the person in the office next to us. It influences our neighbor. It influences the person who's given up hope and thinks there's no way she's ever going to lose the extra 60 pounds she's put on since high school graduation.
Brian, this is really great work. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Brian Wansink is the author of Slim by Design, Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life. Well, with slimness in mind, check out this recipe from Deborah Madison. It's her spring garden hodgepodge, a quick sauté of radishes, leeks, pea pods, asparagus, and tarragon. The essence of the season. Find it, you know where. SplendidTable.org. The word sauce covers myriad things, from the French chefs who are hovering over a complicated dish to the ketchup that you squirt on your French fries. Well, the idea of sauce intrigued Associate Professor Marianne Tebben. She's the director of the Center for Food Studies at Bard College at Simon's Rock. and she's written Sauces, A Global History. Contributor Noelle Carter got the story.
Marianne, I'm so excited to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What would you say constitutes a sauce?
So it's really difficult to define a sauce, I've found. I like to say that sauces are not food, but they're of food, because the basic elements are that it's a refined preparation that's a complement or a contrast to food. So it's edible, but you don't eat it by itself. So you have to have what the industrial food industry likes to call a host food, and then the sauce acts as a complement or a contrast. And so I say refined preparations because you can have elemental ingredients that are food adjuncts that add flavor to food, but they're not sauces like salt. And so the problem is where to go from there. So in my book, I say mainly sauces are smooth, liquid preparations, but that's not true of salsa, for example. It's not true of hard sauce for British desserts. And so then you have to kind of go from there and refine it. And the essential element is that it's something that adds flavor to food, but doesn't stand on its own. And there the debates begin.
How far back do sauces go? When is the earliest documentation?
The origin sauces that I talk about start, this is about 5th century China, and they're condiments. And I should say that the origin of the word condiment means it's something that adds flavor to food. And so these original sauces are fermented meat condiments. And again, this is 5th century BC China. And those meat condiments are written about, and they're described as to food what a general is to an army. So they sort of lead and perfect and correct food. And those meat-based fermented sauce preparations turn into soy sauce eventually. So the meat is replaced by soy, and those are fermented sort of more paste than sauces. And then you get to soy sauce around the 3rd century AD. And soy sauce dominates China for a long, long time. And then it gets imported into Japan around the 12th century AD. And you see fermented sauces go from there. And then in more water-centric countries, you have fish sauces, which a lot of people know about. So Indonesia, Vietnam, you have these fish sauces. And garum, the Roman sauce, fermented fish sauce, is roughly around the same time. And so the fish sauce in Rome is relatively similar to the fish sauces in Vietnam and Indonesia. And those fermented sauces are the oldest sauces. But vinegar is a component of other sauces, and vinegar is roughly contemporary to those early meat-based fermented meat condiments. So those are the origin sauces, and they lead into all kinds of other sauces, including the ketchup that we know now, which started out as a fermented product, was fermented mushrooms or walnuts originally in the English version, and it becomes a tomato preparation much, much later.
One thing I found fascinating was, contrary to popular myth, sauces were not made to disguise bad or putrid food, but more as a condiment to complement the dish.
Right. So the origin of sauces are these fermented preparations. And I talk about sauces as contrastive or complementary. And the contrastive sauces are these preparations, sometimes they were spice mixes, that were meant to correct food. And so the idea, this is from Galen, and this is late antiquity. The idea is that foods on their own, meats, for example, have a certain humor, and they're either cold or hot. And it has nothing to do with the temperature of the cooked food, for example. It's the inherent quality of the food. So meat was thought to be cold, not all meats, but some meats were thought to be cold, and you wanted to counteract that with something hot, like pepper. So in order for the food to be nutritional, in order to be digested well, you'd counteract, contrast it with something like a sauce. And it wasn't to cover putrid meat, because meat was expensive, spices were expensive, and so the person who's eating meat has enough money to buy fresh meat. And it was to make the food nutritionally sound. And that practice continues for a long time until about the 14th century, and there's someone called Magninus in Milan who writes a book talking about the contrastive quality of sauces, and he also says that sauces can be useful nutritionally because they make food taste better, and when food tastes better, you want to eat more of it, and that can be a nutritional benefit, as long as you don't eat too much. And that's when the idea of contrastive versus complementary starts to change. And you see in the 14th century, in the 15th century, in the Renaissance, these sauces that become less contrastive and more complementary. And the big change is butter. In 1651, there's a French chef, La Varenne, who is the first to introduce a butter-based roux for thickening sauces. And this changes French sauces forever. And so there was some departure from the contrastive sauce idea around that time, and butter wins the day.
Butter always seems to win the day, doesn't it?
It's true. I agree.
One of your last chapters explores odd sauces, dessert sauces, mm-hmm. whipped cream, cranberry sauce in a can, and more. Where do you think sauces are going, and how has molecular gastronomy changed the game?
I have thought about this, the future of sauce, and it's very hard to predict. Molecular gastronomy is very interesting because this gets back to the definition of sauce. So is it still a sauce if it's a foam or an ice or even a smoke or a scent? And those are all sauces, according to molecular gastronomy. And I think they are because they still complement food. They're a refined preparation. They add flavor. So that's changed the sauce world a lot, but it's really more on the high end. So it makes sauce much more interesting. But I'm not sure on a ground level that that's changed the sauce world too much. We have seen vinegar carry through. So vinegar-based sauces, ketchup is one of them. But there are lots of other examples. And the spicy sauces, Tabasco and Sriracha, are still quite popular. But I was thinking about this recently. What's the next step maybe? And it seems as though everything old is new again. And I was thinking about horseradish. So horseradish is an old ingredient, and horseradish sauce has been around a long time, but I think it's maybe poised for a return because it has, horseradish sauce has that vinegar base that people seem to align with, seem to like. It also has the heat, so it's sort of a daring sauce. So I do wonder if horseradish is not the next step. I'm fascinated by celery sauce. I discovered celery sauce in Pittsburgh Heinz archives.
Huh.
And in the 19th century, it was popular because it was supposed to be healthy for brain and nerve. And it was a common condiment sauce in restaurants for a long time. And it disappeared right around the turn of the 20th century, and you don't see it anymore. But it was a commercial sauce produced by Heinz.
Maybe we'll see that making a comeback.
I wonder.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much. The book was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Marianne Tebben is author of Sauces, A Global History. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now get started with the recipe for Somalian bizbaz sauce. And you're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, was it the ability to make tools that made us human or the ability to cook? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What makes a man, and an ape, an ape? That's one of the more compelling questions we've had answered on this program over our 20 years on the air. Well, we're going back to that interview today. It was with primatologist Richard Wrangham. Now, Richard authored a compelling and controversial book in 2008 called Catching Fire: How Cooking Made Us Human. In it, he makes an argument that what really made it possible for us to evolve from ape to man was the moment we learned to cook. Richard, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
Now, for years and years, we've been told that tools are what separated us from the other animals. But you've gone against all of this research. Why?
Yes, I mean, for many years, it's both tools and meat eating that people have thought has been the critical factors that elevated humans, as it were, from being apes into being humans. And what struck me is that nobody has paid attention to this amazingly important system of food processing, of cooking. And the reason it seems so fantastically important is that we all know that you are what you eat. And we all know that for animals, the search for food is absolutely critical. And what people have not paid attention to is the fact that there's tremendous amount of evidence that when we cook, we get much more energy out of our food than if we eat it raw. And this is so important, I think, that the moment that one of our ancestors was able to do this, they were able to do many things that were previously not available. They could grow bigger bodies. They could use more energy for traveling about the environment. They could have babies faster. They could put more effort into protecting themselves from disease. And they could grow bigger brains.
But what's the science behind this? I mean, I thought that it was this idea that we could have a weapon and we could kill an animal, or we could have a knife and we could cut a plant, you know, and then eat it. I thought that was the key.
The science behind the importance of cooking comes from a review of a tremendously diverse nutritional literature. And what it says is that there are two big ways in which cooking gives us increased energy. One is that it increases the proportion of the nutrients in our food that we are able to digest. So if we eat raw wheat, then mm-hmm. much of the starch that comes into our bodies is simply not available to us to be digested, and we pass it out uselessly. And the other thing it does, cooking does, mm-hmm. is to reduce the amount of metabolic energy that our bodies expend in digesting the food. So if we cook our food, then we save maybe 10, 20, 30, we don't, really don't know, the percentage of the amount of energy that we would ordinarily use to digest the food. And these two things between them mean that when we cook our food, we just get much more energy, much more calories, and then we can use it to change our biology.
So by looking at the remains of early man, could you tell whether or not those creatures at that time were cooking?
I think we can. We can't do it from the direct evidence because there isn't any direct evidence. That is to say, the record of the control of fire just decays slowly as we go back further in time to the point where you don't know whether its absence means that nobody was doing it or that it simply the evidence has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But we have wonderful other ways of getting at this question. One of the discoveries that I made is that humans are incapable biologically of living effectively off raw food. That's because of those advantages that I mentioned of what cooking does to give us energy. And we've adapted to be able to use cooked food. Well, what is it in our bodies that forces this adaptation? There are two obvious things that we can see in fossil species. One is small mouths and small teeth are associated with cooking, and the other is small guts. If we look at our stomach and our small intestine and our large intestine, they're about 60% of the size that they would be if we were a great ape. Well, we can go back in time and say, okay, when did our ancestors acquire these two features of small guts and small teeth, small mouths?
And the importance of the small mouths is that we didn't need to chew as much.
Absolutely right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If we were a great ape, we would spend 6 hours a day chewing our food.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, it wouldn't be like apples and oranges and bananas that have been domesticated by humans and made full of sugar and to be low in all of that fibrous stuff.
Right.
So you'd spend all day chewing it. So you need a big mouth and big teeth to do that. But once you cook, now you're eating high-density, high-quality food, and you can become this rather strange small-mouthed species of ape that we are. And it's clear when that happened. That happened just this side of 2 million years ago, about 1.9, 1.8 million years ago.
Am I making a leap here saying that sharing food or cooking leads to socialization?
Well, you are absolutely right in thinking that many people have followed that line of argument because we nowadays always tend to think of a cooked meal as something very sociable. You know, if you're a hunter and gatherer, you're going through the bush and you eat some raw snacks and that's just on your own. But you bring food back to camp and you cook it up and you sit around it and this is a time for telling stories and for the family coming together and so on. And that carries on into modern life. But the question is why? What is responsible for that? And no one has ever really been quite sure. I've studied chimpanzees for most of my life and one of the extraordinary contrasts that just hits me very clearly between chimpanzees and humans with regard to eating is that if you put some delicious food in front of a bunch of chimpanzees, they all fight over it. Whereas if you put a bunch of food, such as a cooked meal, in front of a bunch of hunters and gatherers, they're all incredibly courteous. And in my book, I do develop the idea, which seems to really work in terms of the animal behavior, that the reason that we are so social in our cooking is that not just that the food is attractive and people want to come and share it for that reason, but that the temptation to fight over the food has led to some very clear social rules. And those social rules, I think, lie at the heart of human society, the rules over the question of how to control conflict and competition and the temptation to pinch food from each other around the fire. And I think that, incidentally, this has been particularly fascinating in terms of gender relationships because men could obviously steal from women because of their bigger size.
Right.
And very occasionally it happens, but it's very, very occasional indeed. And really what's happening here, I think, is that in all societies except modern urban societies, women invariably cook for men. And that seems to be part of an ancient sort of protection racket in which As a result of women cooking for men, then they get men to protect their food from possible theft by other men.
Huh.
And it seems very fundamental to the way we are. I mean, once you start thinking about the importance of cooking, its supply of energy, its strange distribution compared to natural foods, then you think it has really, it's bound to have affected our evolution hugely, our behavior, our society, our cognition, all sorts of features about us.
Richard, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Richard Wrangham is the Ruth B. Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard. He's the author of Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. Now, we're all about cooking here, as you know, so don't miss this week's installment of The Splendid Table Cooks with Frances Lamb. It's our limited-run video series with our friend Frances, who's been showing us some kitchen basics. This week, it's a controversy, how to cut an onion. Now, you can put that new skill to work with a delicious recipe for 3-onion tart with thyme, smoky cheese, and cream. Ooh. You can find the recipe at splendidtable.org. One of the wildest ways you can make beer is with spontaneous fermentation. Now, this is where an infant beer is exposed to the open air with its wild yeasts. If you have control issues, this approach is not for you, but for brewers who like rolling the dice. Those yeasts are the roller coaster ride of the brewing world. Greg Engert is one of them, a champion brewer in Washington, D.C., who's been experimenting with spontaneous fermentation quite a bit. He spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Shear, about what it's like to brew beer while being at the mercy of the elements.
Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So first things first, how does spontaneous fermentation work?
Well, it works just like any fermentation. It's just one that happens wildly and will happen without, you know, a brewer intending for it to necessarily happen. I always like to talk about, you know, when you're in college, you know, I'm not saying that any of us ever did this, of course, but if you happen to leave like a can of beer out overnight and then just tasted it the next day to see if it was okay, it would typically have developed a kind of vinegary note. And that's because swimming around us unseen every day, all the time, are billions and billions of cells of bacteria, yeasts that are all starving for sugar sources. So if you leave your can of beer out or your wine, you forget to cork it, it turns to vinegar because there's a particularly hungry yeast in the air called Acetobacter that will jump in the presence of oxygen. It's an aerobic bacteria and pretty quickly metabolize any remaining sugars into acetic acid, which is what we call vinegar. So spontaneous fermentation is something that can happen all the time. And if kind of controlled a little bit, it can produce some amazing flavors.
How do you control it?
So the first part is what kind of grains you use. Okay, so using kind of grains that are filled with complex starches will make sure that certain bacterias and certain yeasts can't metabolize those sugars. They just can't handle how complex they are. Another way is to only brew these beers in the cooler months. Because one of the things that happens with these beers is after you boil them, were you to expect anything to naturally occur immediately, it won't because the wort itself, the sugar water, is too hot. So if you do that in the cooler months, you get the stuff you want. And if you do it in the warmer months, you might get too much acidity. You might get too much funk. And then finally, you're going to age this now cooled off, starting to spontaneously ferment wort, which is the sugar water, in oak barrels. And over time, we're going to make sure that even as the beer is fermenting in oak and all the other wild yeast bacteria in the barrels are working, there's going to be some evaporation. And so the levels, we call this the angel share, the levels of the beer itself are going to drop. We want to keep that oxygen out or else we're going to get vinegar. And we do that by literally just adding more beer on top.
Wow, that is fascinating. Well, you've brought some beers along with you today, some of these sour beers, these lambics we're talking about. Can you talk us through what you've brought, and then let's taste some?
Sure. The first one is from a blender named DeCam. The blender himself is named Carl Godot, and he's a brewer at a brewery called Schleichmulder in Belgium, but then his weekend job is blending spontaneously fermented lambic. So this is a beer that was actually bottled in 2012. It's called DeCam Oda Lambic. Spontaneously fermented, and then aged in oak barrels, where it continues to ferment. because all those wild yeasts and ale yeasts and lager yeasts and bacteria that are in the air are also in the oak barrels because, you know, oak has sugar in it. And so these wild yeast and bacteria will feed on the oak until a new sugar source presents itself. So once we get this lambic into barrel, it's going to continue over the next, in this case, 3 years to develop sour flavors, funky flavors, and pick up some nice oaky tannins and vanillins as well.
And the color is beautiful.
It's beautiful. You'll see it's a little bit darker gold, and a lot of that comes from the oak itself.
And quite an aroma.
Yes.
With a lot of other beers I've tried.
Intense aroma. And you also notice that it's not carbonated. This is actually blended from three-year-olds, and then it is not re-fermented in bottles. So it's still, but with the amount of acidity we have from this, it's like with wine. It doesn't need carbonation because it's naturally uplifting on the palate from its natural acidity.
Let's give it a taste. Ooh. That funkiness you're talking about.
Yeah.
Definitely there.
This is tart. It's obviously more sour than, your IPA or something that, you know, is quite hoppy and bitter. But it's got this really, really well-integrated acidity. You get the tannins, that kind of woodsy, drying quality from the oak. But everything's in balance. And I think it's wonderful. And I don't think it needs carbonation. I think it's wonderful as a still beer.
All right, let's taste one more.
This is a fruited lambic from Pierre Tilquin. He's also a blender, so he buys this spontaneously fermented beer from other brewers, and then he ages it in his barrels, blends it together, and then in this case, this is called Tilquin Quetch, which is a plum lambic. So you're going to taste those kind of funky, wild, mildly tart, drying, oaky flavors that we tasted in the Decam Oda lambic. But now you're going to have this really interesting influence of plum. So he steeps this spontaneously fermented beer on plums, which is very interesting.
Oh, I taste the fruit. I definitely taste the fruit.
In steeping this, the wild yeast and the bacteria continue to ferment a lot of the sugars of the plum, but they leave a lot of that color. So you get this beautiful kind of light, almost like violet gold color coming through. And the aromatics of the plum work in nicely with that kind of perfumed earthy note. But then on the palate, it's got this plum-like juiciness that is so incredible. And I really wanted to pour this for you because I think a lot of times when people think of lambic, they think of sweet fruit lambics. Brewers like Lindemann's and Bellevue, Dutroc, these brewers from the same region, they make spontaneously fermented beer. But in order to survive throughout most of the 20th century, when people weren't interested in sour beer, they weren't interested in funky, wild, beers that were reminiscent of barnyards and horses and things like that, they were looking for something that was a little bit more simple and direct and, frankly, more like soda pop. And so what they would do is they'd take their funky beer, they'd filter it, they'd pasteurize it, they'd add fruit juices and syrups, sweeten it out, and then sell it as creek, which is cherry lambic, or framboise, which is raspberry lambic. Luckily today, the traditional lambics are coming back, so we have unfiltered, unpasteurized, all-natural, dry, tart, and aromatically complex lambics from a number of producers.
So these beers, they're so different, they're so wild compared with a lot of the more mainstream beers we have. If we go to a bar and we want to order this kind of beer, we just ask for a sour beer?
I think, nowadays that's probably your best bet. The thing about these real lambics from Brussels and the Pays-Land is that they're getting increasingly rare and hard to find. Luckily, though, our burgeoning American craft beer scene is picking up the slack and producing a host of sour, funky beers, some spontaneously fermented, others just deliberately fermented with wild yeast and bacteria. So, yeah, if you're out at a bar, just ask to see their sour list, and you're going to find something that you like.
Will they be impressed that I'm asking for a sour beer?
Yes, in fact, they will be impressed.
So these beers that you're pouring today, you're serving them in wine glasses. Is that typical with this kind of beer?
It is, actually. And to be honest, I mean, any beer that is well-made and filled with, you know, beautiful complexity belongs in a wine glass as well as any wine. You get to swirl, you get to focus aromas with that glass, really dig in with your nose and pick up the bouquet. Certainly these beers that are so complex and alluring, they really benefit from being in a wine glass.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today and for bringing along your lambics.
Thank you.
Greg Engert practices spontaneous fermentation as the beer director for the Neighborhood Restaurant Group in Washington, D.C.
Rebecca Shear is a journalist based in Washington, D.C. Now, you can find a list of those beers they tasted, as well as a guide that Greg wrote especially for us. It's an insider's guide to spontaneous fermentation at splendidtable.org. Coming up, your calls and an audio tour of craft milling in North Carolina. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time for us to connect. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can call us 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Kate's calling from New York. Kate, what is on your mind, madam?
Hi, Lynn. So great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too.
I'm calling because my husband brought me Yotam Ottolenghi's book, Plenty More, for Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
And it's amazing. And I heard about it on your show, of course. And I made the tomato and roasted lemon salad, and it called for pomegranate molasses.
Right.
Which I just moved to New York, and one of the best things has been finding absolutely any food or spice from anywhere.
That's right.
So fun. So I found pomegranate molasses, actually several types, like with no problem at all, and made this great salad, and it was really tasty. But now I have this whole bottle of pomegranate molasses, and I'm not sure what to do with it.
Let me count the ways, Kate.
Okay, no, I have to give you some stipulations, because I'm vegetarian.
Right.
My husband says it'd be great with some meat, but I told him that that's not going to happen. It's great on avocado toast, which is like the only thing I've branched out to do with it so far.
I've never tried it on avocado. That sounds great.
That was good, but I need some more ideas.
Well, let me tell you, I like to mix it with a little bit of vinegar or fresh lime or lemon juice. Okay. And then I'm always throwing garlic into things, but a tad of garlic and some black pepper. And then what I do is, as I grill vegetables like zucchini, tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, onions, corn on the cob.
Ooh.
Brush that on as it grills, and it'll start to go bubbly, and it'll, you know, just burn that just a little bit that makes it sticky and delicious, and it is just out of this world. The other thing that's wonderful about it is take good yogurt, some nice organic yogurt. Put whatever kind of fruit you like in there. Mm-hmm. I love bananas. I mean, when cherries are in season and strawberries, they're all wonderful. But I love bananas. And then you just streak. You do a zigzag over the top of the bowl with the pomegranate
syrup. That's a really good idea.
Oh, it's
sweet,
so
it would go with sort of a dessert kind of idea.
Exactly. It's delicious added to whipped cream, small amount of it. It has a lot of acid in it, so you have to be careful. But it tints it, and it gives it a lovely, lovely flavor. And the other thing I like to do with it is a blue cheese. Believe it or not, just do a little streaking on blue cheese with it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's really good on a lot of different cheeses, but especially cheeses that have assertiveness to them.
Oh, okay.
So and like that glaze that I mentioned to begin with, you can vary that in many, many ways. But it's just delicious. Try it on roasted broccoli.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and on steaks, you know, you can make cauliflower steaks where you just cut it in half. And you cut.
Oh, yeah, and then grill it?
Well, what you do is you take the whole head of cauliflower and you just slice it top to base. And the center cuts will hold together. And you can call them cauliflower steaks. And you roast them or you grill them. Yeah, you're having steak. Just tell them, and you're brushing it with this lusciousness.
That is a great idea. Okay,
I think you'll like that.
I'm going to find more because now I'm going to run out of it.
Yeah, you're going to have to get a supply. I'd do a half case to start with.
Oh, great idea. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care, Kate. Bye.
Bye.
800-537-5252. That's how you can get to us. And check us out on Facebook and Twitter. I should have mentioned to Kate, there is a Lebanese recipe
on the website by Maureen Aboud, and it's called Mahogany Eggplant. And this is what she does. She takes pomegranate syrup and a bit of oil, and she brushes chunks of eggplant, and then she broils them. And it gets sticky and crusty and just delicious. So check that out. Meredith is calling from Essex, Massachusetts. Meredith, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I have a really great grocery store near where I live that does us all a very nice service by putting the ends of their deli meats out for sale when they can't slice them anymore.
Oh, yeah.
They get too small.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's really a great kind of home economics kind of thing, you know. So this way you can, you know, get some you know, nice stuff. Like they'll sometimes put out the prosciutto di Parma, which, you know, you know how much that costs.
Yeah, this is not a bad thing. Exactly, exactly.
Right. So, you know, I'll grab these and take them home in my basket. And then I realize, wow, you know, I've got a lot of prosciutto di Parma here and I don't have a deli slicer, nor could you slice it even if you wanted to.
Right.
So, you know, I've tried a couple of different things with it. I've cut it up in small pieces and fried it to sprinkle it on salad or,
that
you know,
great.
taken a chunk to put in a soup to flavor the soup. But I've kind of run out of ideas for what to do with this stuff. I'm wondering if you can help me out.
You are bringing back such a memory. A long time ago, I worked a week each in three trattorias in Milan. I was doing a story for an American magazine. And one of them was a hole-in-the-wall place, a Tuscan trattoria that specialized in steak. And they would cook over a wood fire, and they would trim the ends, you know, little bits of fat, the meat, you know, bits and pieces, and they would put them aside. And the other thing they did is when they came to the end of the mortadella, the salami, because they served an antipasto, and the prosciutto, they would put those ends aside. And what they did is they would grind that all together. Now, we could use a food processor. You don't want to puree it. You just want to, you know, break it up and grind it.
Right.
With onion, garlic, they'd add a bit of wine. They would add a bit of tomato, maybe tomato paste. They were making essentially the most succulent meatballs you have ever put in your mouth.
No way.
Yes, they would use, they'd take a bit of, you know, the ends of the bread.
Yeah.
They would make fresh breadcrumbs out of that, crust everything. They would put that all together with an egg. And then what they would do is they deep fried them. We don't have deep fryers sitting around. What you do is you can then brown it in a bit of olive oil and just let it cook a bit, maybe with a bit of tomato or just a bit of wine. And you have got, oh, they are so good. And every time you make them, they're going to be different.
Wow.
And now that prosciutto is very intense. So
yeah.
With that, you do want breadcrumbs. Maybe you want to add a little ground beef to it. You see what I'm saying?
What the bulk of it would be.
The
yeah.
bulk of it would probably be something like ground beef, but even a little bit of pork, because you want some fat in there. The prosciutto is pretty lean.
Oh, and you know, I have some great pork in my freezer from the farm across the street. That's probably a perfect candidate for the
Oh, that's
meatballs.
Ideal. That's ideal. Yeah. And it'll feel very at home meeting a pig from Italy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they'll get on brilliantly.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, you
great.
Could throw, by the way, you could throw pine nuts in there. You could throw fresh herbs, fresh basil leaves. Oh, they'd be wonderful in there.
Oh, so, I never would have been able to come up with that. What a fantastic
It's going
idea.
To be, you can make these forever. And you can, you know, make them tiny so you can pop them in your mouth. You can make them big and you can cook them with the sauce. I mean, you just go on forever.
Can I make them ahead and freeze them?
Of
and
course you can.
Oh,
of course you can. Absolutely. So,
sounds like a good summer appetizer to me.
It sure do. It's to me, too. In fact, my mouth is
well,
watering.
Come on down to Essex and have some with
you. You sound like a great store. Hey, thanks, Meredith.
Hey,
great
thank
question.
You,
take care.
No problem. All right, bye-bye.
Bye. By the way, this idea is a great way to use scraps and bits and pieces you may have around the house. Or mix vegetables in, like cooked spinach, bits of broccoli, that kind of thing. And then make meatballs. They're really great. There's a growing awareness that industrially produced flour, even supposedly whole grain flour, is not quite as whole or even wholesome. For one thing, the standard roller mill process that produces most of our flour separates out the oily, nutritious germ and exposes the flour to high temperatures that deplete even more of what nutrition is left. Now, for reasons of freshness, flavor, sustainability, and nutrition, locally sourced stone milling initiatives are springing up across the country. Carolina Ground is in Asheville, North Carolina, and it's one of these new mills. Founded by Jennifer Lapidus, Carolina Ground is run by women. The mill's approach to flower production is craft, not industry. Multidisciplinary artist Carla Seidel brings us this snapshot.
There's something very significant, I think, about two women running this flour mill. I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's there. And the fact that it's so ancient, what we're doing, and that we're two women doing it.
I think it's the emotion and the intuition and just being connected.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Lapidus, founder and general manager of Carolina Ground.
I'm Kim Thompson, and I'm the miller.
Stone milling, this is the original method. In fact, before that, there was stone on stone.
It is an ancient art. It's, if not the oldest, one of the oldest forms of mechanized production for creating food. So I can't not feel intrinsically connected to history.
I always remember one of my early jobs in college was I was working as a lab tech for an archaeologist, and one of my favorite things to separate out when they'd come in with a dig was to find a mortar and pestle. And it's that basic in a certain level, like, oh, just crack it into flour.
I just think about the story of the wheat that we bring in and where it's been and feeling responsible for continuing it and where it goes afterward.
Why are we doing it? I mean, food security, the fact that our industrial food system is based on cheap fuel, that's a finite thing. It makes a lot of sense to start rebuilding these community food systems.
You can't not pay attention to what's going on. Time, temperature, touch.
On this front end, you're seeing that this houses the stones, and grain that is fed through the hopper directly through is our whole grain flour, and then we have a bucket elevator that will carry that to a set of screens that will create a sifted product.
Even the packages themselves, the bags, we write by hand. It's the littlest thing, but I love writing the date that it was milled. I do that with a Sharpie by hand.
What you see now, most modern milling is done with steel rollers, and it's a process known as gradual reduction. The steel rollers are separating the bran from the endosperm and the germ, and they're gradually reducing it down to extract the starchy endosperm flour. For industrial food production, it was a win-win. It meant that you could have vertical integration and centralization of bread wheat production, and the shelf life was suddenly not a problem.
I like to randomly write quotes on bags of flour, especially when I'm stacking pallets, to kind of hide one in there, like little Easter eggs. It could catch someone's eye and make them think more about what they're about to do or what they're a part of.
Before all of that, pre-late 1800s, our country was dotted in stone mills, community mills, and it was more of a craft than an industry. When you're milling intact and the germ is crushed into the endosperm and all of it is coming through together, it's spreading those oils through the flour so you can really feel it.
It really is a huge contrast if you actually touch it. It just feels almost like it's creamy. It's crazy to me that the whole other process is to actually remove things and put it back when it's already there.
It's amazing to me sometimes when I look at the ingredients on a loaf of, you know, I wonder why they call it bread, you know, that kind of bread where there's this list of ingredients and, you know, the idea of enriching our flour, coming back in and putting nutrients in when it was all pretty much there, basic, simple.
I feel like once you have experience with something like this, you can't really go back.
I think people are hungry for heart and for authenticity. I think that's part of what we're delivering.
I think a lot about how my life totally depends on the faces of people I will never see. I wouldn't even be standing here without people that I'll never know. It's a chance to get to be a part of something that connects people.
Carolina Ground is located in Asheville, North Carolina. Carla Seidel is the founder and producer of EarthFlavors.net. And that music, by the way, is a traditional milling song from Cameroon. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from James A. Garfield, who said, "Man cannot live by bread alone. He must have peanut butter." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. SplendidTable.org has everything you will ever need. And if you like what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We have quite an archive of conversations with the people who shape America's food scene. You can find us at iTunes or at SplendidTable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.